Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show for Young Adult Cancer Survivors. I am Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talk, and I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on how different are issues faced by young adult cancer survivors. This is the 24th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and the show is featured on Block Talk Radio. Before we begin with today's introductions, I would like to share the fact that in August, Cure Panel Talk Show is celebrating its first anniversary. We launched the Cure Panel Talk Show in August 2012 with our monthly series on multiple myeloma, and we have grown over the year to conduct talk series on a variety of topics, including prostate cancer, yoga, nanotechnology, and cancer and nutrition. Please visit our website, www.trialx.com/curetalk, for information regarding our shows. And you can always mail me, priya@trialx.com, if you would like to be featured on our show. Today, we are launching our new talk series, Cure Panel Talk Show for Young Adult Cancer Survivors. Over 70,000 young adults aged between 15 to 39 years are diagnosed with cancer every year in the United States. According to the NCI, in the past three decades, cancer incidence in young adults has increased more than any other age group, and cancer has become the number one disease killer in young adults. It would come as a surprise to many that the cancers that affect young adults are very different from those affecting other age groups, and young adults have entirely different and unique needs from other age groups. The panel today will be discussing how different are issues faced by young adult cancer survivors. We are excited to have with us young adult cancer survivors who have inspired young people all around the globe. New York Times Life Interrupted columnist, Sulekha Jawad. Sulekha was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia at the very young age of 23 years. Sulekha underwent a stem cell transplant for her cancer, and post-chemotherapy, she's getting better every day. Founder and CEO of Stupid Cancer, Matthew Zachary. Matthew is a 17-year pediatric brain cancer survivor. He founded Stupid Cancer, an advocacy, support, and research organization that works for survivors and care providers with the aim to end isolation, improve quality of life, provide information regarding resources to young adults with cancer, and form a community where young adults in cancer world can share and help each other. Soccer player and the 2002 winner of the reality television show Survivor, Ethan John. In April 2009, Ethan was diagnosed with CD20+ Hodgkin's lymphoma and has undergone two stem cell transplants to control his cancer. Ethan serves as a national ambassador for Stand Up to Cancer. Ethan is also a global envoy for Life Strong and Movember. We also have with us Huffington Post blogger and project manager at Azul 7, Erica Laddie. Erica is a breast cancer survivor and advocate for young cancer patients. Azul 7 is a design consultancy that works to make the medical system more human. Erica also holds a Master's of Arts in Food Studies at New York University, where her research focused on the prison food system and its industrial size. I extend a hearty welcome to everyone. I would like to remind all listeners that we will be taking live questions at the end of the discussion. Listeners who have a question for our panel can let us know by pressing 1 on your keypad, and we will bring you live on air to ask your question. Hello, Sulekha, you're on air.
Hi there.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually with Erica and Ethan, and we are currently on a boat on the Clark River in Montana. So if you hear sounds of waves, that's what's happening in the background.
So, like, let's, I think it's been 2 years since we connected with each other. It's so good to talk to you finally.
That's wonderful. So, good to talk to you as well.
Yes. So, like, you have been fighting cancer for the past 2 years now, if I'm right.
That's right.
So, how did it all begin? Can you please share your story with us?
When I first started to feel symptoms, I felt tired and worn out. But like so many other young adults, I attributed it to burning the candle at both ends. It wasn't until I started getting frequent infections and colds that I finally went to the hospital and realized that there was something wrong with my blood count. It took about 6 months for me to get diagnosed, and I was finally diagnosed with myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myeloid leukemia 6 months after graduating college at age 22.
Wow. How was the support from your friends and family? I know that your brother was your donor, and your mom, I read a lot about your mother in your blogs. So how has been the support from your friends and family? I'm sure it was getting motivated.
My closest friends and family were really wonderful. But I think that, like a lot of other young adults, I felt incredibly isolated. I was a few years too old for pediatrics, but decades younger than the other patients in the adult oncology ward, and I really didn't feel like I fit in. It was only until I started writing about my experience and sharing my story publicly that I started to get to know other young adult cancer survivors and started to feel like I was able to form a support group, not only of like-minded people, but people who had shared these really difficult experiences.
Hi, Matthew.
Hello there.
Matthew, how are you, Matthew?
I am great. How are you?
Fine. I think it's been a year since I spoke to you last.
It's been a while, but I've missed you.
How have you been doing?
Really fantastic. My kids are healthy. I'm well. The organization is thriving. And it's a good day to be alive.
Yeah, great. Matthew, you're a 17-year cancer survivor. What is your cancer story?
I was a classically trained concert pianist for 10 years by the age of 21. In undergraduate, I was planning to go to grad school to be a film composer and study at USC Film School. Until my left hand started experiencing symptoms with fine motor coordination, I went misdiagnosed for 6 months and was ultimately diagnosed with pediatric brain cancer and given just a few months to live because they had really seen something like that. Neither of those came true. I am celebrating 18 years this December. I'm still playing piano, but I had a major course correction at a very early age and was unable to become a professional pianist. I wound up working in the advertising agency universe for 10 years and rehabilitated my left hand to play again 5 years later, and then finally started meeting some other young adults who had gone through similar experiences, which was transformative, that inspired me to start a nonprofit organization that raised awareness for young adults and their unique needs in the world of cancer.
Wow. Ethan, now I bring you on air now. I'm glad to connect with you, Ethan. Can you hear me? Hi, Ethan.
Hi, how's
it going? Ethan, you're a soccer player, a reality show winner, and a cancer crusher. How did you cope with your cancer diagnosis?
The first attempt because like I said,
Ethan, could you please be a bit more louder? I'm not able to hear you.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, better now, definitely.
I know. I just said before I get started, I want to give a quick shout out to First Ascent because we're all floating down a river at an outdoor adventure camp for young adult cancer survivors. So it's pretty exciting, and that's one way that we've all been able to manage our diagnosis and manage our survivorship because we're just connecting with other young adult cancer survivors right now.
Okay, that sounds great. I can't see Erica. Is she? Erica, if you're on air, if you're dialed in, please press 1 on your phone so that I can.
Oh, actually, I'm here. We're all sharing
okay,
your phone.
Great. Hi, Erica.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for dialing in, Erica. It's great to have you. Erica, what was your initial reaction to your diagnosis and how long has it been?
You know, it's been about a year and a half. It was basically, as you can imagine, a shock. I didn't have a genetic history of breast cancer in my family, and I only found it when it spread to the lymph nodes, so there was a lump in my armpit. I didn't have any suspicion of disease. I felt fantastic. So for me, it was a great surprise to be diagnosed. I mean, a horrible surprise to be diagnosed with cancer at age 28.
So how was your support that you received from your friends and family, and what are some of the things that have kept you motivated?
Yeah, you know, I felt like I didn't have a ton of connection to the young adult cancer community until I found Suleika and Stupid Cancer. So for a long time, I felt pretty isolated in my disease, and I think that's a common issue among young adult cancer patients because it's just such a strange time to have cancer in your life. You're really at the apex and all of your friends are maxing out on life, having kids, getting married, you know, succeeding in their careers, and to be hit with such a gnarly disease it's really isolating. But I did feel supported, you know, in my family and friends.
Okay. So I guess we're all here now, and the topic for today's discussion is how different are issues faced by young adult cancer survivors. Matthew, stupid cancer must be coming in contact with young adult cancer survivors from all over. What is the most worrying aspect that you have encountered about young adult cancer survivors?
I would have to say that there's a lot of us, and we don't know there's a lot of us. And those that don't yet know that there are a lot of us are in for a major life transformation when they discover that. And it's truly a transformational. I say that word twice on purpose because it really changes your life when you realize that you're not alone and you have peers out there that know what it's like. As much as your friends and family are wonderful, it's not the same and it's never the same as meeting somebody who got diagnosed in their 20s and 30s. And I think that's the most tangible and meaningful thing that we offer and that is necessary to talk about in the world of young adult cancer. And that is the basis under which I started the organization.
Okay. And do you find something which is hopeful and optimistic about the cancer population that comes to stupid cancer?
There have been three very significant sort of sea changes in oncology in the last couple of years, and I'd like to take pride in and credit in having the young adult cancer movement sort of mobilized to influence those changes. The first of which is that there's now a clinical journal of adolescent and young adult oncology out there, which produces real white papers, real publications, and real research studies unique to this age group, this unique biology, unique outcomes. That's a huge step in the right direction. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which is the de facto gold standard by which all primary care physicians, subspecialists, hematologists, oncologists are delivered standards of care, now have a young adult cancer protocol that was released last year, and that is incredibly significant to the movement. And third, that the American Society of Clinical Oncology has launched a campaign for CME programs called Focus Under 40. So those three things in the clinical world are ridiculous to say that they actually happened in such a short period of time, but they've been so heavily influenced that I can say with confidence that in 2013, young adult affected by cancer today is much better off than they were 5 years ago.
Oh, that's really great. Do we know what percentage of cancer patients are young cancer patients, young adults?
I'm sorry, what was the question? How often?
What percentage of cancer patients are young adults?
I'm sorry, it's breaking up a little bit.
Yes, okay. What a percentage of cancer patients are young adults?
We define the age range based on a public health policy brought forth by the CDC and the National mm-hmm. Cancer Institute, which defines young adult as 15 to 39.
Okay. What are some of the common cancers in that age group?
And that's a really important question to ask because cancers change based on age. We don't see a lot of the traditional cancers, colorectal, mm-hmm. prostate, and lung in young adults. Breast cancer happens in young adults, but not nearly at the same proportion as it does in older women. Young adults get, like Suleika, actually all three of you get blood cancers, ovarian cancer, sarcomas, thyroid cancer, melanoma, and testicular cancer. And it's very important to recognize the significant differential that young adults get different cancers than every other age group.
Okay. Suleika, what is your opinion regarding the different issues that are faced by young adult cancer survivors? What, according to you, are the two most important issues that young adults face today?
I think one of the things that was most difficult for me was that I was inpatient in isolation for a combination of 6 total months leading up to my transfer and an opportunity to go to young adult cancer events or to support groups. And I think that made me feel even more isolated. I found myself looking for a voice in the media that I could relate to, and I really didn't find that. Many of the people who were writing about their experiences were writing from the perspective of being in remission, or were authors who were many decades older than I was. So I couldn't relate to a lot of what they were saying. But one of the things that helped me cope with that isolation was writing. I'd always wanted to be a journalist, and right around the time that I got diagnosed, I'd been hoping to go and report on the revolution taking place in Tunisia, which is where my dad's from. And with the isolation, with the diagnosis, I really felt like there wasn't much for me to write about. There was no way I was going to get on a plane or to travel into some foreign revolution until the day that I had this epiphany and realized that I could report from the front lines of my hospital bed and that I could write about the revolution taking place inside of me. And that's how my New York Times poem, Life Interrupted, was born. But one of the things that was really important to me in writing that column was trying to be as brutally honest and as raw as possible. I think oftentimes when we talk about cancer, we talk about the silver linings, and there's this emphasis on staying positive. But I didn't always feel that way. And I really wanted to write from the trenches and to report not only on the good, but also on the bad, and to talk about topics like fertility, infertility, and sexual health, and things that we don't often hear discussed in the news.
What are some of the hurdles that you had to overcome with regard to your career and maintaining your energy levels post your cancer diagnosis?
Sorry, what was that? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Ethan, what are some of the hurdles that you had to overcome with regard to continuing your career and maintaining your energy levels post your cancer diagnosis?
Well, for me, I think it was very cathartic to, you know, share my news with, you know, the public. You know, it's one of those, there's a lot of stigma still associated, you know, with people diagnosed with cancer. And so somehow I realized that maybe the details of my life had the opportunity to help others out there. You know, and like Suleika said, it's a very isolating experience. Everyone goes through cancer alone in their own separate way. And I felt that, you know, by, you know, having a video blog and, you know, sharing my story on, you know, television and with my friends and family and people.com, I really felt that, you know, people could relate to me in some strange way. And in that sense, if you're sitting on your couch in the middle of, you know, nowhere, feeling alone, that you're like, all right, well, maybe this guy, you know, I'm like this guy. This guy has issues too, and this guy is going through cancer, and he's doing okay. I can do okay as well. And for me, it was, you know, a tough decision to go public with my diagnosis because it's a really gross, ugly, disgusting time of your life, and I didn't know what would happen if I opened up my life to complete strangers all over again. But for me, it was one of the best decisions of my life, and I was completely overwhelmed with the support of everyone out there, you know, all the fans and, you know, people at Stupid Cancer and people at First Descents, and how welcoming they were and how generous and selfless they were towards my fight. And, you know, seeing that gave me the strength and gave me the courage to go out there and continue fighting and to, you know, get through this with the help of everyone.
Oh, that's really positive. Ethan, what according to you is the most important problem that young adults face today? Young adult cancer survivors.
Sorry? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
What according to you is the most important problem that young adult cancer survivors are facing today? I think we dropped Ethan.
Oh,
yeah?
Sorry. No, Ethan's still here. Do you want to have him answer that?
No. Yeah, I think Gabby just dropped Ethan's call now. Erica, are you online?
Yep, I'm here. This is Erica.
Okay, all right, Erica. Does the fact that you're a young adult cancer survivor affect the attitude of your buddies at work?
You know, it's interesting because when I was diagnosed, I was working for a company that was almost like a family to me, and I felt very lucky to be supported through my diagnosis, though I certainly didn't let everyone at work out of 100 people know that I was sick. I felt very supported, and when I left that job, sort of just after finishing treatment, I was really nervous to reenter the workplace as, you know, a sort of high liability insurance risk and, you know, just a risk in general for a lot of employers. So I was very fortunate to find a company that was interested in actually making the medical system more human and empathetic and was therefore open to me having gone through the experience I'd gone through because I'd sort of been in the trenches and I had seen that side of things. But I think a lot of people that are in treatment or post-treatment deal with a lot of needing to hide what they've been through at our age, needing to hide that they're a cancer survivor from their prospective employer because it's seen as a risk instead of a positive aspect of their resume. I didn't have a choice because I've chosen to go public with it. I've written about it, but I've heard many a war story about people, you know, getting rejected for a job with no other reason than, you know, the idea that probably they're a survivor. So I've been, like I said, very, very lucky, but I think it's a huge issue that the young adults face as survivors.
Yeah, that's a really positive story, actually, because mostly in our shows, we have people saying how they're discriminated against in their workplace once their cancer diagnosis come out. So this is certainly very inspiring. I would like to now introduce our patient panel. We have with us Karen Crowley. Karen is a stay-at-home mom who was diagnosed with multiple myeloma in 2005. She chronicles her cancer journey in her blog, Adventures of Cancer Girl. We also have with us Heather and Cameron born St. James. Heather was diagnosed with mesothelioma in 2005, just after 3 months of giving birth to her daughter. Heather, together with her husband Cameron, embarked upon a fight against mesothelioma. Today, Heather is a 7-year mesothelioma cancer survivor and continues to provide unending inspiration to mesothelioma victims around the globe. Welcome to the show, Karen, Heather, and Cameron. Karen, you're on air. Karen, you were diagnosed with multiple myeloma and you have a little girl. How was
yes.
it when you first heard about your cancer diagnosis and how have you been coping?
Let's see, my cancer diagnosis came, I just went in for a regular checkup at my doctor. I felt fine, I didn't have any symptoms, but my blood work came back that there were some abnormalities, and the diagnosis came from that. And it was multiple myeloma, which is something that typically much older people get. There are very few people in their 30s that ever get it. So I've never been in remission all this time, but I take a medication every day that I've been coping just, I guess, by writing on my blog and trying to find other survivors my own age, which is kind of hard. But
I'm sure you're doing great, Karen. Karen, you can ask a question to our panel now.
Okay. Yeah, well, I've been able to meet other cancer survivors my own age online, but out in the real world, the people that I'm friends with, you know, most of them don't have cancer, and so sometimes it's hard to have conversations about it or know when to bring it up or if I should bring it up. So do you have any tips on how to approach the topic with non-cancer people?
All right, well, this is Matt. I guess I can start that. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
One of the biggest challenges that I've seen, not just as a survivor, but as a nonprofit guy that's trying to build community, is that while there actually are legitimately 800,000 Americans that are still under 40 who have had cancer or are living with it, God knows where they are. And
mm-hmm.
it's been very difficult to cast a net to bring them together. But between First Descents and Stupid Cancer, which I consider two of the more dominant brands in our sector, we've been able to build a huge alumni network of people who benefited from our programs and services. And when combined, it's a significant amount of people. If you go to an FD retreat, which Ethan, by the way, I'm going next spring, so haha, and I know it was kind of on me about that. That's kind of like open bar night for a week in Idaho, on a river. Stupid Cancer has 14 regional chapters on Facebook with about 3,000 or 4,000 people combined, and we host live in person meetups in, I don't know, maybe 30 cities or so around the year. So that's a way that you can connect with survivors in your region that you may not even know are there.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as what I understood you were saying, having to act, quote, normal, quote, around your, we call it non-survivor citizens,
yeah.
is really how you want to define what that relationship means to you. I'm not a therapist, but you have to decide what role you want them to play in your life. Are they your caregiver?
Mm-hmm.
Are they your therapist? Do you just want to go out drinking with them? And if they don't really understand what's going on, I would encourage you to tell them to visit First Descent's website and our website and learn why you are a distinguished individual in the cancer list.
Yeah, I would just add to that, too. Like, while there's a lot of amazing organizational happenings, I think just on, like, a person-to-person level and dealing with this as a young adult, just being honest with people, but also, like, one of the things I think that Talika and I talk about a lot is that
Cancer can make you incredibly self-centered and really angry at the world, and it's about sort of trying to transcend some of that too and understand that nobody's going to get this until they've been through it themselves.
Erica, would you like to add something? Erica is on air?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, would you like to help Karen out here?
I'm sorry?
Karen was asking about how to connect with young adult cancer survivors.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think, you know, I don't know what came through here, but some of the organizations are just absolutely amazing, and I've been so lucky to be a part of them. But on a person-to-person level, I mean, specifically First Ascent, this has been, like, an incredible experience. But on a person-to-person level, I think just being honest with people and at the same time realizing that cancer can make you, like, you know, a really, you know, sort of different version of yourself and make you angry at the world. So it's kind of like towing that line between being able to be honest and open with everyone to the point that you can, but also, like, being forgiving and allowing people in your life to make mistakes, because they're not going to understand what you're dealing with, probably,
right,
hopefully, ever. So, you know, like that's the weird sort of dance that we all do as survivors, figuring out how to, you know, acclimate them, but also, you know, not be angry.
Yes. Karen, I hope that helped.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we have a couple of more questions for our panel. Please, I go ahead and ask them. Karen, if you have any more questions, you may ask them. Yeah.
Are you still on me?
Yeah. You have
okay.
A couple of more questions. Yeah.
Well, another question. Every month when I have to get my medicine, I go through a lot of bureaucracy, like with the pharmacy and insurance and medical stuff. I don't know if any of you have any tips on how to deal with a lot of that, just bureaucracy and awfulness.
There's an organization called Triage Cancer. It's a bunch of lawyers that do sort of free consulting to help you. I'm going to make a random reference. In the movie The Incredibles, he played like an insurance salesman who knew like all the secret back doors and got in trouble for telling that client what to do.
Uh-huh.
They're like those people. And I'm glad you got that reference, because if you didn't, it'd be weird. But he's like, that group is kind of like that person, where they know the world that it works in, and they can tell you what to do and how to say things and get things done. And there's another group, I'm not sure how effective they are, but they're called the Patient Advocate Foundation. They're in D.C. And they're worth checking out, even to see if they might be able to give you advice or help you. And I think they also have powerful attorneys, like Aaron Brockovich kind of attorneys, that just scare the bejesus out of insurance companies to actually do something when you threaten them.
Okay.
Thank you, Matthew. We have with us Heather and Cameron, her husband. Heather is a mesothelioma survivor. Hi, Heather.
Hello.
You're on air, yeah. Hi. How are
Hello.
You?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine, Heather. Great to talk to you finally.
Yes. I'm glad to be on here.
Yes. Heather, why don't you share your mesothelioma story with everyone?
I was diagnosed in 2005, just 3.5 months after the birth of our only daughter. Throughout the whole pregnancy, I never really gained any weight. And after I had her, the doctor said, you know, you're a little anemic. You might want to keep an eye on that. And I just never really recovered. And I kept losing weight and getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And finally, 3.5 months after her birth, we got the diagnosis of malignant pleural mesothelioma, which is a cancer that's almost always associated with asbestos. So when we came to find out, I was exposed to asbestos as a child. and there's a 20 to 30 year latency period between exposure to asbestos and the onset of the disease. It is usually affects much older people, mainly men who worked with the product, you know, back in the day. So being 35, 36 at the time, at Mayo Clinic had only heard of one other young woman being diagnosed at my age. So given me 15 months to live if I didn't do anything, and I just had a baby. So needless to say, we sought out the world's leading specialist in the disease in Boston, and I had surgery to remove my left lung and followed that up with chemo and radiation, and I'm still here 7.5 years later, cancer-free, no evidence of disease anywhere. So,
well, that's really great.
I'm happy.
We are happy for you. Heather, if you have a question for the panel, you may please go ahead and ask them.
You know, I deal a lot with other patients like you guys do, and the mesothelioma community is very small because only about 3,000 people a year get diagnosed with it, so it's really rare. And I lose a lot of friends. And do you guys deal with that, the loss of, I'm sure you do. You get close to people by, you know, being their advocate or just being a friend. They sought you out, and then you lose them. How do you deal with that? This summer's been particularly devastating in our community, and I'm reeling from the loss of friends. And do you have any tips or, you know, just maybe encouragement on how to handle something that's obviously part of our lives, you know, and will be?
Like they're speaking. I can.
Matthew?
There's no good answer. It never gets easy. It's interesting you brought up that specific topic today, because just today we have a teen spokesperson. Her name is Lauren Scott, and she was diagnosed with a sarcoma at like 11 and a half, and she was in and out of treatment for years and years. She just turned 16. She came to our conferences, and she passed away today. And it's been horrible and devastating for tens of thousands of people whose lives she changed, including my own. And I'm in a strange position. I lost my brother-in-law to cancer. I lost my mother's best friend, my aunt, to cancer, my grandfather, myself. I had it. And we lose people here in the organization every week, every day. I've had to build a thick skin to it, but it's not the same for other people, and it never gets easy, and you're allowed to grieve, and I think it's okay to give yourself permission to accept that this is horrible and it happens, but you're still here, and how do you want to choose to use that information to live a great life?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Suleika. I can really relate to what you're saying. One of my very, very best friends, whom I met in treatment 2.5 years ago and has the same disease as me, and who I had my transplant with, passed away on Valentine's Day. And she didn't have family around, so I was her main caretaker, and I was with her when she passed away. And it's been really difficult for me as well, and I think that there isn't an easy answer to how to deal with this. But I know that one thing that helps me has been finding small ways to pay tribute to her and to honor her memory. She really loves, she supported this rescue animal farm called Woodstock Farm Animal Sanctuary, and we took a trip up there the other weekend in memory of her. And just last week, right around the time that she was transferred to hospice, she had talked to me about how badly she wanted to spend some time on the beach and just fly away to a tropical island. And I had the opportunity to go down to the Caribbean. And I thought about her a lot, and I wrote about her. And it's just, I think these small acts of remembrance and finding little ways to kind of keep her alive in my memory that have helped me, but also talking to other people who are grieving and dealing with loss in that way has been incredibly helpful.
Good. I mean, yeah, that's all really, I mean, it's kind of what we're doing, you know, and it's just comforting to know that other people go through it. I mean,
yeah.
that I'm not alone or, you know, so.
I think the other thing that happened for me was when, especially because we had the same disease, when she ended up not doing well, I started to worry that I was also going to relapse. And
yeah,
I think that as when you fill the role of when you're both a cancer patient and a caregiver, you straddle these two very different but equally difficult roles. And I think it's easy to feel like this is going to need me or this is what's going to happen to me. And I know that personally I've dealt with a lot of survivor's guilt.
Yeah.
Where I wonder why her and not me, and that's something
mm-hmm.
That I think, once again, there isn't an easy cure or an easy solution to, but just talking about it and giving yourself permission to talk about it and to grieve has been the most helpful thing for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Heather. I'm sure diagnosis of cancer must be one of the most painful moments in anyone's life. Shilajit, what motivated you through those moments?
What motivated me to?
Yeah. To get what motivated you to do these moments? Of being diagnosed with cancer at such a young age, and I'm sure at that point not knowing what future holds for you. What was that one pillar of strength that you held on to?
I think for me, the thing that gave me the most strength was not only finding, but creating a community for myself. One of the best things that's come of going public is getting to meet other young adults and other people who are going through the same thing. And I really cherish those friendships. That's part of the reason why right now I'm out in the middle of the wilderness with 14 other young adults. And I think that, you know, even though we don't talk about cancer all the time, just knowing that you can go there and knowing that every single person has been in your shoes, even if we've had different diagnoses, provides a lot of comfort and a lot of strength. I know that for me, coming here was a big struggle. I still do chemotherapy, and I didn't know if I was going to be strong enough to travel by myself and to get into a kayak and spend the whole day on the river. But just meeting those kinds of personal challenges and the community that understands and supports you has been really wonderful. I think we're all stronger than we realize, and there's just an extra strength that comes with realizing that.
Yeah, definitely. Great. Erica, breast cancer, you're a breast cancer survivor. Breast cancer at any age will be very traumatizing, definitely more so when you're very young, in your teens or your 20s and 30s. What kind of support is available for young adult girls who are diagnosed with breast cancer?
What kind of support? Yeah, you know, what I thought was really interesting about getting breast cancer at a young age was that I didn't to relate to people that were so. For me, I think the breast cancer community is mostly oriented at the maybe 40, 50, 60 plus range. So for me, it was about sort of, and I know there are great organizations like Young Survivor Coalition and others that do cater to the younger breast cancer community. But for me, it was like more effective to just talk to other people with cancer in general. So meeting people through Stupid Cancer and First Defense has been more pivotal than any sort of, you know, specific breast cancer organization. I will say that having, you know, breast cancer at a young age and having to have mastectomies and having to date under those circumstances is incredibly difficult. And without having met anyone else that's gone through that at a young age, it would have been very, very difficult. But I have found certain people within, you know, the more general young adult cancer communities that have been through those things and have helped me through them.
Okay, yeah. Matthew, I've been reading that there's a lot of, there's low participation of young adult cancer survivors in clinical trials. Can you tell us why is this so? Is this because there is a lack of awareness of clinical trials among young adults, or are there no clinical trials which take in young adults specifically?
This is more of a systemic issue. It's not unique to young adults. Trial adoption is around 3 to 5% for everyone that isn't in pediatrics. Pediatrics has a mandate for trials, and that's mm-hmm. because they're minors and they have no choice, but it has proven over 35 years that trials actually improve outcomes. And that's why something like childhood leukemia, which was a death sentence 30 years ago, now has a 95% cure rate for these kids. Trial adoption in older adults, my working theory is that people don't understand what it is. They think they're guinea pigs, they're going to get placebo. It sounds scary, and there's a lack there's a need to destigmatize it more. From an actual implementation perspective, patients don't know they exist, doctors forget to think about them, and they're usually only considered for late-stage disease. And again, that's not unique to young adults. That's pretty much anyone over 21.
Okay, so does Stupid Cancer extend support and help to people, to young adults who would actually like to take part in clinical trials? Do you connect them up with labs that do take in studies that do take in young adults?
No, that's not really part of our mission. We do talk
okay.
about it on our radio show, and we do several workshops throughout the year called Debunking Clinical Trials, but we're largely an organization for people who are kind of beyond that point, or if they're going through it, they're beyond it, and they wouldn't necessarily need to know about trials, but they like to know that if they can pay it forward in any way, that young adults would benefit from trials. The workaround that's been going on these days is that given the lack of adoption in Americans over 21, if you are a young adult diagnosed with cancer and you happen to get treated in pediatrics instead of adult oncology, there is a much higher likelihood you will be optioned for a trial if you qualify.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. At this point, I would like to remind our listeners that if you have a question for our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad and we can bring you live on air to ask your question. Meanwhile, we have received questions via email and we would just go through them. Ethan, this one is for you. Has being a sports person helped you, given you an advantage to fight cancer? Ethan is with us? I think Ethan Klein
yeah.
has.
Sorry.
Yes, Ethan. There's a question for you which says, has being a sports person helped, given you an advantage to fight cancer in terms of stamina, endurance?
Being one thing I was discussing with a bunch of people today in terms of stamina, endurance to beat cancer. I think leading a healthy lifestyle in general is a great way to beat cancer. Because if you're leading a healthy lifestyle, you're eating well, you're exercising a lot, if by chance the horrible thing happens to you, you're in a better shape, you know, to get through what you're about to face. You know, for me, exercise and fitness was my way to get through cancer. You know, I needed to set little mini goals for myself and accomplish those goals. It built my confidence. And that's what helped me get through, you know, the most difficult times. You know, some people use meditation, some people use acupuncture, some people talk to other people, see a shrink. But, you know, there are plenty of organizations out there that offer great services for people that are recently diagnosed or who are going through cancer or who are survivors. And that's really what this is all about. That's what this radio show is all about, is connecting with everyone out there who has been touched by cancer. You know, whether you are going through yourself or you're a caretaker, it's really important to, you know, find your motivation in whatever aspect of the disease is hit you.
Ethan, you are running marathons, I think, just before almost 10 months after your stem cell transplant. And we had MLB coach Don Baylor with us in our show on June, and he too was back on the field, I think, within 3 weeks of his stem cell transplant. So do you think this quick recovery is something to do with the sports?
Getting through, like I said, you know, running a marathon that quickly after my transplant, and I actually ran the New York City Marathon while going through treatment. And then I ran the Boston Marathon after my second transplant. Everyone's making fun of me because I'm bragging right now. But, you know, it feels good to say that. You know, it feels good to be able to accomplish those goals. And listen, running isn't for everyone, and I hate running as much as everyone else. But for me, it was my strength. It was what, you know, allowed me to focus, and it helped me, you know, clear my mind. And I think, you know, everyone needs that in their life, especially when they're going through such a horrible situation like cancer.
Suleika, I think you were also training for a marathon. How did the training go? Suleika is on air.
Oh, sorry, what was that? We're having trouble
yeah,
hearing
like,
you.
Yeah, last time I think we connected, you were training for a marathon, and you're going through chemotherapy at the same time. So how did you manage that?
So I actually had a very different experience from Ethan. I started training for a marathon about 9 months after my transplant, and my big running dreams lasted about only 20 days. I actually ended up back in the emergency room on a morphine treat for non-cancer-related reasons, but with a running injury. So I think that for me, I really wanted to be one of those cancer survivors who finishes their treatment with a flourish and who climbs a mountain or runs a marathon. But I just wasn't ready for that yet. And it was a really important lesson in learning to listen to your body and learning that change only really happens. Settle with going from 0 to 20 and taking it easy and learning and remembering to be kind to my body, which is often easier said than done.
Yeah, that's right. We have a caller who would like to ask a question. The caller calling from 212. Please ask your question. Caller, you're on line. Please ask your question.
Yes, I hope you all can hear me. I'm very... very happy to hear all these stories, and such a motivation just hearing everybody's story here. And I have a couple of sort of questions, and you know, all of you can, maybe Matthew can and Suleika can address some of these, but it's open to everybody in the panel. One is a little bit more on like when you heard the diagnosis and how much, you know, how many months or years did your doctors give you? And you know, hearing everybody here, it sounds like you know, totally hope and wish that you all totally live beyond that initial period that they said. So my question is that what did they tell you, and is there an online database that tracks you know, what was the initial life expectancy at the time of diagnosis and what people are, how much they have outlived that initial diagnosis, because I think that's really useful information for a new patient to see that, no, the diagnosis is not the final, the life expectancy is not the final word. And there are so many people out there who have outlived that initial expectancy assessment by the physician. So my question is around that. Like, what did your doctors tell you, and is there a database that tracks this?
Well, this is Matt. There are thousands of cancer registries in this country, and none of them talk to each other. So any stat any doctor gives you is based on his particular assessment of which registry makes the most sense for him to quote from.
Mm-hmm.
I just tell people, don't listen to your doctors. I mean, listen to them for what medicine you take, but if they, I was told they'd be dead in 6 months, 18 years ago. So my position is, I'm not a statistic. I'm myself. Treat me like me, and I'm going to ignore Dr. Google, where I can research the ugly stuff on my own. I was also diagnosed during Clinton, so it was 18 years ago, and there really was no attention paid to doctor communications with patients, sensitivity, social work. You were really kind of a bit of a piece of meat. And that's changed today. The narrative changed, the dialogue's changed, and there's a lot more appreciation for the individuality of the person. But also patients are smarter now, especially younger patients. And I would say if you're not happy with the way your doctor is talking to you or thinking about who you are, get a second opinion and leave. They're your customer. And if you're not happy with them, then fire them and find someone who cares about you.
Thank you. Thank you. If anybody else can describe their experience, that will be helpful. But I did have another question, and that was discussed more to in relation to the emotional stress or trauma that happens. Is there any data or studies that have looked at the correlation between emotional and traumatic stress in addition to the cancer diagnosis, and what kind of correlation is it, 10% or 20% of patients who have emotional stress in relation that is documented, and do insurance companies support emotional related care, and is there, I mean, do they support it? So I'm trying to understand what's the occurrence of this correlation between emotional trauma and the diagnosis, and how much do insurance companies really support such supportive therapies?
The answer is just going to piss you off. No. On occasion, insurance companies will cover sort of a psychologist or a therapist, but usually there's a free therapist in the cancer center. Only recently, some insurance companies in this country, and they all suck, are in charge of making sure that they do some good for patients, and they're now covering, like, acupuncture. But they won't cover nutrition or wellness or well-being or physical therapy, and it really just depends on who you are, where you are, where you're treated, and what your carrier is. From the perspective of research outcomes and published white papers on the relevancy of psychosocial well-being as a marker of quality of life, there are dozens of studies about those over the last 10 years. I'm not a researcher. I don't know what they are or where they are, but you could find them probably on PubMed. And everything that you think it says, it does, where your quality of life is tantamount to your quality of care and vice versa. And the more the more mental clarity you have during and after your treatment, the better outcomes you have long term.
Thank you. What are some of the main events or conferences that a young cancer survivor focused? I know Stupid Cancer conducts Oh My God, OMG, media get-togethers, and what are some of the other events that are planned this year?
Well, we now produce two OMG Cancer Summits every year, one in the spring and one in the fall. The one in the fall is on September 28th here in New York City at the New York Law School. The website is east.omg2013.org, and we produce our seventh annual OMG Summit in Las Vegas next spring, which is omg2014.org. Those are our two principal programs. They take up a whole lot of time. They take a year to plan. And they've become incredibly successful. And again, going back to emotional well-being, we conducted a research study on emotional well-being before and after our conference, and we've now been able to scientifically quantify that our engagement with that patient engagement with our programs meaningfully improves quality of life, which helps improve outcomes at the same time. We also produce a live radio show once a week for the last 7 years. We host social meetups around the country, and we partner with cancer centers to produce what we call boot camps, which are sort of regional workshops that cater to the specific topics that young adults care about most, like fertility, insurance, dating, parenting, bereavement, fear, anxiety, self-image, reconstruction, and career planning.
I'm sure that's very helpful. I think we are almost completed our show time. We launched the Young Adult Cancer Panel, Young Adult Cancer Survivor Panel discussion today. What we aim to do with this program is to address issues that are specific to young adult cancer survivors. Thank you, everyone. It was great to have you all here. You took time out, Sudeika, Erica, Ethan, and Matthew. It was absolutely great to have all of you together on the show. I thank all the people who are listening, and thank you all for your support. We look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show. We are discussing Diabetes Cure on August 12th. At 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time. For more details of our upcoming show, please visit trialec.com/curetalk. The link to today's show will be sent via email to all participants. Thank you. Thank you very much.